Let me apologize in advance for the way my friend behaves. He'll pick a fight and take a holy stance. He's so proud that he's so safe.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
By the things my friend will say, he holds a Bible like a dagger, and he twists it just that way. He just loves conversation like a cat loves a bird. I guess he's always been a good man in the worst sense of the word. In the worst sense of the word. The good knights went out to save the day.
Well, usually when we talk about a guest on our show, we have a generic blurb that gets sent in from their publicist, but I wanted to take a moment here just to explain who this gentleman is from my own words. David Wilcox, I first saw about 8 years ago at the Basement in Sydney, Australia. It was the first time I can remember actually being mesmerized by a performer. Hadn't happened prior to that. I couldn't decide whether it was his ingenious chord structures, his mellifluous vocal stylings, or his captivating storytelling, which kind of won me over. But whatever it was, I was absolutely gobsmacked at the end of the night. I guarantee that if you have an ear for some of the finest guitar arrangements and your soul is thirsty, you will quickly fall in love with this incredibly creative and intuitive human being. Please welcome to the Drew Marshall Show, Mr. David Wilcox. How are you, David?
I'm good, thank you.
It's quite a build-up. I hope you live up to it.
Yeah.
The first thing that needs to be said off the top, if you've already noticed, is the man has one of the most clinically insane laughs of any human being in the world. Have you ever worked on that? Like when you were dating, when you were single, did you have someone say to you, dude, if you want to get a woman, you need to not laugh like that?
I imagine that has probably, that would have been good advice. The only advice I remember getting was, I think it was about maybe 11th grade or so, and this friend of mine was saying, yeah, well, I can get you a job at this place where I work, but when you talk to the owner, don't laugh.
Oh, you're a champion. Yeah. Well, and you did land quite a catch, Nance, the acupuncturist. Huh. How long have you been married to Nance for now?
Let's see, I guess it would be 17 years, I think.
Good for you.
And we tend to count our anniversaries from when we met, which is almost 20 now, so it's really fun.
Yeah, yeah, my wife and I hit the 20-year anniversary mark this past year. So living in Asheville, North Carolina, do you get a chance to bring out the big unicycle very often?
I do, and yet it requires putting it in the car and going somewhere, because we live up on this hill, and if you were to start where we live, you could go about 100 feet, and then you'd be going 100 miles an hour and die.
Nice. I hate when that happens. Your son is going to be driving this year. Nathan, he doesn't have his license yet, does he? It's soon, right?
He's had his permit for a year, and he will be driving by himself in just a few weeks.
It's scary. I have a daughter who's just in that stage as well, same age, and oh my goodness. Maybe it's different for boys and girls, I don't know, but when you think of your kid out there in those metal machines, don't you get a little nervous?
It is a rite of passage. For lack of a better one, our society makes it this really big deal, and the machinery itself is not a big deal, but the what we put onto it in terms of trust and the levels of, you know, we're having to realize that, okay, a lot of our job is done now. Hmm. And that's a huge rite of passage. But I think, you know, Nate is such an awesome kid. It's really an honor being around him. I keep telling him great compliments, like, I'm so glad for the ways you're not like me.
Oh, my goodness. Every parent, I think, has said that for sure. Yeah, thank you for not taking on those attributes of mine that are quite wrong.
Yeah.
How's Jing doing, by the way?
Ah, she's just marvelous. She has company where friends are traveling, and they left their dog with us. So now we have two dogs that are very, very buddies together. So
good, good, good.
We're just walking in the woods this morning. It's a beautiful, sunny, crisp day here in Asheville, and the woods is lovely, dark, and deep.
Do you ever wonder what you'd be doing in life, David, had you not chosen this path back at Antioch College?
I have, and I hope I would have kept the yearning alive that music has given me, and I hope I would be doing something adventurous and about conflict resolution, or perhaps really helping people steer toward what's going to make their lives really juicy and make their story kind of matter to them. But I wonder if without music I would have had the contrast in my life, because music was always this oasis of perfection. There was this one place in my life where my heart felt so good. And because I knew what a heart could feel like, it always challenged me to ask all those questions about, well, how can I bring this into the rest of my life? How can I feel this way about my relationship, about my, you know, my neighbors, about where I live, about, you know. And so without that contrast, I might have not known what my heart was asking for. And so sometimes I come to the guitar with just tears of gratitude, because that was the place where God saw, he's susceptible, he's open, his heart knows this language. So let's show up as music, and he'll get it.
Nice. Nice. Again, very well said. David Wilcox, American singer-songwriter, on the phone with... We always have to say American singer-songwriter here in Toronto because of the Toronto David Wilcox, as you well know.
Great musician. I went to see him many years ago. Before I was actually a musician, I was on vacation in Toronto with my parents, and I don't know, I might have been ninth grade or so, and my mom was reading the paper and said, oh, look, here's someone with your name. Oh, he's playing tonight. And so I went to hear him at the Riverboat Cafe.
Oh, my goodness.
It was great.
Did your parents go, too? I hope not.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, because that wouldn't have been a concert for their ears, I don't think, would it?
Oh, he was folky when I saw him.
Oh, really?
He was playing acoustic, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Great.
All right. Hey, Northeast Ohio, Mentor. Is that the town you grew up in?
Yeah.
What kind of dysfunction did you grow up in?
Well, I grew up around parents who, different stories, but my dad was someone who was raised by sort of the last generation of a bunch of Methodist ministers, and he got the sort of institutional kind of framework. But his dad apparently was really stern and not really communicated the heart of it somehow. So he decided all tradition stops. And so my dad was a psychologist and would feel the yearnings of his heart, but somehow never look beyond what could be verified with the senses. And so there were the subtle realms of life that always frustrated him. And so alcohol was probably the best friend he had found, because it was a place where not only did he kind of have permission to feel, but he could numb out from the questions that his heart kept asking. And my mom, really tough life as a kid, you know, and also a lot of tradition that she decided stops right here. And she decided kind of the Spartan sort of persevering, she wouldn't let herself kind of feel too deeply anything. And so, for example, she seemed to be kind of immune to music her whole life. It was a real surprise 10 years ago when she mentioned liking a particular song, and I sort of raised my eyebrows, really?
One of your songs?
No, actually it was a Billy Joel song called River of Dreams.
Huh.
For some reason, that song just grabbed her. But it was a great way to grow up for me, to have parents that decided there would be no teaching of tradition, because what it did for me was it let me experience God without language. Even as a kid, I had this sense of the kind of abiding grace and the sense of wonder and awe that I was so curious. I just felt like, wow, maybe I've been singled out. It seems like a lot of society doesn't know this exists. What am I feeling here? How do I know this? And little by little, I you know, found out about great traditions, and yet for me, it was better to learn it first at a kind of a personal, like, you feel your own heart beating in your chest, and you feel this undisputable yearning. This is not theology. This is kinesthetic. This is some being. And when you start there, it becomes not sort of like, what do you believe? It becomes, what do you want from your life? What are you going to do with this challenge? And so I thought it was a great way to grow up.
I think it is. It seems like clean slate kind of stuff, I guess, right? Except maybe your dad, did your dad pass down the angry driver sort of, you know, did he genetically pass on the Captain Wanker syndrome, or?
He did. As a matter of fact, the family joke is when I start acting, you know, sort of rude and brash and like, hey, that guy cut me off. They respond to me like with my dad's name. They say, okay, George.
Oh, nice.
Well.
Nice. That's quite an ingenious song, I might add, Captain Wanker. Folks, you can find it in all the great stores. Airstream for 2 years. When Nate was 12, you took off. You know, my family and I did something similar. We packed up our, sold our house, packed up our belongings, and took 9 bags of clothes, 2 children, went to Australia with no place to live and no job, and said, all right, God, let's see what's going to happen.
Yeah, great.
And so when I heard this journey that you did in the definitive trailer, folks, Airstream is the stereotypical. When you think of an American family driving around with that panel station wagon and the silver rocket behind them, mm-hmm. 2 years in the Airstream.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Give me a high and a low from that trip.
Well, a lot of the best memories are the conversations that we had, just us as a family. There were times when, you know, it's way past Nate's bedtime and he kind of has this idea that springs to him. And if he was off in his bedroom, and we'd never hear it. But because we're in this little 28-foot Airstream, he says, Dad, that guy today who we were talking to, when he said, and, you know, our first response is, Nate, you're supposed to be asleep. But these are the stories that come out because we're close enough to really hear each other, and it's dark and you can feel the wind, and we're kind of close enough and yet in this different sort of setting, that the strict roles of mom and dad and you can't talk about things that matter to mom and dad, those roles kind of disappear because we're out in the woods. And so there were times when that beautiful window of openness stayed open, even though Nate was going through the times of 7th and 8th grade. And because we were homeschooling during that time, we got to show up in Nate's life not just as the usual role of this is what he had to rebel against, but we were sort of off in our little lifeboat on the big ocean. And so we kind of got pulled together. And it was wonderful. Now Nate's heart is still open and he's still so kind to everyone, even his parents, really all the time. It's miraculous.
What about a downside to the 2 years?
Well, when it was raining, the little house, you know, when we had to be inside, we had to learn this Airstream dance where, you know, one person's kitchen in the kitchen with the cooking and one person's walking by with the with the laundry basket, and you just really have to, everybody has to know where everybody else is. It's all this beautiful dance. And so there were times when it felt really, really close. And when I was first shopping for the trailer, I remember talking to this salesman guy, and he was saying, well, is this going to be kind of a weekend thing? And I said, no, we're going to go out for probably 2 years. 2 years? Oh, no, you need something a whole lot bigger than this. I'll tell you what, these things get real small after the first week.
Wow, I didn't know Jeff Foxworthy sold Airstreams. That's pretty good.
He's down there. So So yeah, we wound up deciding that that's kind of part of what we wanted, was to have that experience where Nate got to see all of us and we got to see all of him, all of the sort of the pressure cooker kind of parts of our personality. And so there were times when it definitely did feel really small, but that's kind of what we signed up for. And so even that, like the song Perfect Storm, is about the fact that sometimes those times of adversity wind up making the best memories of the whole trip.
On the phone with David Wilcox, American singer-songwriter extraordinaire. Folks, if you've not heard his tunes, you need to hook into them. And Airstream is a CD you can definitely pick up. But that was released last year, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah.
That was your 2008. Coming out with another release this year as well. Boy, you're on a bit of a roll, aren't you?
It has been so fun recording this recent one. It's all done. I just sequenced it a couple days ago, and so the manufacturing is beginning, and it'll probably be out in late March, I would guess.
Okay. All right. Did you have fun setting up with the Pro Tools?
Actually, this time we recorded old school to 2-inch analog tape, and it was really fun.
Nice. Do you ever look back and cringe on any of your songs, like even as far back as The Night Shift Watchman?
There are a lot of songs that I can still find a way to get inside it and sing it. It's sort of like a photograph that's a really good picture, not of me, but of who I used to be. And there are other songs that are really embarrassing because I was trying to be someone that I'm not.
Hmm.
And so those are the songs that I sort of go, oh, no. Yeah.
As a songwriter, you seem to be the type of guy who, I guess rather, you sort of stretch your words over the melody.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you do it?
It makes for better songs. It takes longer for me, but if I write the music first, the music is definitely better, and the words tend to require more time, and that somehow gets them distilled into a... They seem to be able to hold more of the real good stuff.
A song has to do something. It can't just be cathartic.
Yeah.
That's a great quote from you.
Yeah, it's a cleaned up version of this phrase that my friend, another songwriter, Jamie, used to say to me. Because when we first started writing songs, there would be songs that were just kind of like, I'm feeling this, and the whole song is basically, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling this. And she would say one day, you know, that song is just sitting in its own poop, you know. It's just not getting up and doing anything about it. And I'd say, oh, yeah, maybe that's what a song is really about, like not just giving up into, oh, this is what I'm feeling, but actually saying, okay, and what are you going to do about it?
Right.
So I love when a song can really go to the places where we get stuck, the places where we tend to, you know, wind up falling into the same traps or just kind of go to those dark places where we can sometimes go. But a song that not only has been there, but has really been able to follow that light out of there and mark a trail.
Apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, but apparently three songs have come to you in dreams.
Two of them on this recent CD, the first song on the CD and the last one, both I got the whole chorus in a dream, and that's has been rare, but it is kind of cool that when that happens. The one time that I woke up from a dream feeling the kind of grace and just extreme beauty that I hope I will feel, you know, as my soul leaves my body. There was this song that I was hearing as I had this dream, and I woke up and could still remember the song. So right away I was, you know, recording and writing and finding a way to capture that. And music has always been for me this beautiful challenge of here's a hint that comes in music that teaches me not just who I am, because I don't want to sing about that. I know about that. I have to live with that. But music has shown up to teach me who I am becoming, who, you know, sort of like what God is making here with all this stuff of my life and this yearning in my heart. And songs show up with a vision, an emotional kind of snapshot of what it would feel like to actually get this life, to actually know that, yes, my heart is beating for a reason. Like, I am part of a story that's bigger than I know. I'm a cell in a living organism that's bigger than I can see. And I have this kind of sort of purpose that is set for me here. And, you know, these are fine words, but when you know that and you have this kind of sense of, oh, my God, I'm alive, that's what I love so much about music, and that's what I've asked for from music my whole life. And so, like, waking up from a dream where that feeling was very strong, it makes me come to that little phrase, that music, that those words, and say, okay, if this is a clue, where is this leading? And so I enter back into that musically, and I say, it's like finding a little piece of a machine and saying, okay, what is this part of? And if I were to try and complete this, what would it look like? And so the craft of writing to me is not about filling in the form. It's about finding a way to respect the questions, the yearning, the unsettled promise that my heart keeps speaking through this sound, and keep asking to be shown more of that. And because what I really want is for my life to feel like that, not just to make sounds and make words, but I want to learn from the microcosm of music sort of how to make my time here sing.
Unknown folk singers were known to be the biggest influence on your musical life. Greg,
yeah,
is that like Greg Greenway in Boston back in 78?
Yeah, I loved getting to know a lot of musicians who... It's for me, the most important thing was, it's sort of like, instead of watching someone land on the surface of the moon, the most important step for me was the step that was like the next step. Okay, not just landing on the moon, but here's the guy who actually opened his front door and took the step down onto the front porch and started off. So what was really inspiring to me was not just the people who had made it, but the people who had begun it. Yeah. And so I was so encouraged to know that music was not just something to be left to the professionals, but music was a language that my heart had been given for a reason other than just pleasing the industry. It was something that I needed to follow like a compass and trust that it was lining itself up with a yearning that was bigger than just making more songs.
I was at Loggins and Messina concert last year, and beside me was sitting a very famous folk singer. You might know his work from a movie called A Mighty Wind, Eugene Levy. Did you get a chance to watch that movie?
I did.
Eugene Levy has the biggest eyebrows I've ever seen of any human on the face of the planet.
Yeah.
Funny movie. I mean, just... It had all the subtle nuances, and if you dug the scene for any particular point in time, you'd get it. I mean, how do you tune and talk and make sense all at the same time? That has got to be. I mean, obviously you don't have ADD.
I have just enough of it to make it work for me.
It's unbelievable. And this multiple capo thing. I mean, did you invent this or did you steal this off someone else?
I started cutting capos in 78, and it was just because I was trying to get a particular chord that would just break my heart. And it was a chord that I didn't have the skill to kind of stretch my fingers that far. Mm. And so I started figuring out, oh, how can I sort of get the guitar to do some of this work so that my hand doesn't have to stretch so far. And I started having capos that let particular strings pass through. And so for me it was... what I loved about music was that it would surprise me, and that it wasn't just something that I would control, but it was something that would actually sort of lead me into places that I didn't know. So I love having the guitar be different in terms of the intervals that it's tuned to or the capos or the whatever. And all of that just sort of helps with that sense of wonder instead of just sort of having music be something that's obedient to me. I want to be obedient to where the music's taking me. So
let's talk about your axes, Olsen, and how about that new Rain song, Carbon Graphite?
Yeah, both great guitars. I love the Olsen for the heart. It just feels like it it inspires me the way the notes blend together. And the Rain song is very different. The tones are somehow pure in terms of they don't interact with each other and create these interesting difference tones. But it's a simpler sound, but very very clear and direct. And both are interesting for writing. They write different kinds of songs.
I had a great conversation for my goodness, it was about an hour with Mr. Olsen. I've just forgot his first name.
James,
that's right. We're talking about his spiritual journey and where he's been and some disappointments over the years. And I need to get him on the show. That guy has got a heart of gold.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
I just love his attitude. He's so humble.
Oh. Great. A couple of friends of mine in Australia would love to hear about your setup as well. Apparently you have a few different pickups on board that you combine, including a MIDI pickup for triggering a bass keyboard module.
Well, it happened one day that I was looking, every guitar player who's searched for a sound has this drawer full of old pickups. And one day I was thinking to myself, oh man, all of these pickups are just junk. And then I had this notion, I said, wait a minute. Each of these pickups is junk, but all of these pickups are pretty good. It's sort of the difference between a single voice and a choir. I realized that each pickup was really good at one part of the frequency spectrum. So if I just used all of them and each one only did what it was good at, I would eventually create this choir of guitar pickups that all built into one guitar that could actually create the way it sounds. And so that's what I've done, and it works great.
What do you think happened to the days of Joni, James, and Jackson?
I think that they started something that's still rolling, and luckily, you know, like each spiritual journey, it appears new. It grows fresh like grass through the cracks in the pavement. I think what they started was the notion that songwriting was not something that was supposed to be kind of slick and professional. Songwriting was a way of communicating honestly person to person, sort of the difference between like writing signs and writing letters. And when singer-songwriters started really being honest about not just portraying a character but really leveling with their listeners as to what it really felt like, there was this beautiful window to be able to come to music with whatever feeling you're having and find company there, find people who had felt exactly what you had felt, and go as deep as you can with your best friend on a long drive when the conversation gets good. There was a song that could be that close and that honest. And, you know, before that, songwriters thought that their job was to create songs that didn't seem like they were from anybody in particular. They were just kind of like signs instead of letters. And so I think Joni especially, well, a lot of people like Judy Sill, started this really honest thing where they were basically trusting the listener to come to them just person to person, and not as, you know, the songwriter was no longer representing the industry, but just, you know, speaking directly.
American singer-songwriter David Wilcox on the line with us. David, three guys that have, I think their music has impacted me in very unique and interesting ways. Mark Hurd, Phil Kagi, Bruce Coburn.
Yeah.
Even Larry Norman, to some extent. Have you heard any of Larry Norman's stuff?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. There are very few people that seem to permeate my head these days. I'm just too narcissistic and too pessimistic and any other istics you want to throw in there. But I'm warming up, and folks, you know what? I think back to I was sitting out with a buddy of mine by his car in a parking lot behind a pub in Australia, and he said, "Guys, come here, you got to listen to this." And he threw in a cassette tape, and it was your music. And we all sat around. Gee, it would have been 11 or midnight, listening to your tunes. And then a few weeks later, we went down to the basement in Sydney and watched you perform. And that's where I was first really introduced to your shtick, your thing. Mm-hmm. And I went up to you and I said, I'm not sure my wording. It probably wasn't the best at that point in time because I was a pastor back then. I think I said something like, "Are you a Christian?" To which you gave me the most convoluted answer. And I walked away frustrated, and I was glad I was frustrated because it made me listen to what you were saying more. Mm. My friends were also frustrated, and they sent me some emails and said, "You got to ask him these questions." So is there, in your opinion, more than one way to God?
Well, I think that there are a lot of languages that God is willing to speak. And I think that for me, I am very grateful that the yearning that my heart knew how to speak was received and answered. And so this is a question that I don't feel like I have great words or wisdom about, but I know that I have gratitude for when I first started listening to my own heart's yearning and saying, you know, what is this? Where is this taking me? When I would take a step towards that, when I would dare to say, this is the most important decision of my life and I don't know what to go on, and I would take a step in humility and prayer and say, God, can you help me? I don't know what to do, but I want to feel alive like this. I want to feel moved like this, and I want to feel and every time I would take one step, it felt to me like that grace, that love would come 100 steps toward me, and I started to feel very welcomed and the odd part for me is every time I would kind of try to capture that feeling, every time I would say to myself, well, you know, the last time I did this and this and this, I felt that grace. And so let me just do this and this and this. Let me, you know, pray in this way and say these words. And I would say the same words, and I would say, God, come on, you were there last time. What's up? And my experience kept, it was as if what I was being asked to do was to walk and keep walking and not just move to one place and stay there. It felt to me like this walking was asking me to continually have that experience of coming to God with, I don't know, I don't have the formula that can make my heart, you know, suddenly feel close to you. I don't have the words that hold your spirit. I don't have you are bigger than my idea of you. And so every time I would try to have my own little sort of rituals, I would find that, well, yes, it's good to show up and punch in, but I can't create anything with my rituals. I can't, it requires the bowing of my knowledge of my head to my own, the pounding in my heart that says this is more important than me, you know, sort of coming up with my ideas of what I'm, you know, what I'm believing in. It's more important for me to come to God with humility and say, you know, this is not, I'm not going to win the prize by what I know.
Right.
And so at that very personal level of answering this question, I would say God has made all kinds of people. People who have beautiful minds, people who have beautiful hearts, people who have beautiful compassion, people who have the ability to be so, to hold people with a consistency and a strength, and people who have mercy and gentleness and forgiveness. And for all these hearts, there is a walking to God and a letting those unique characteristics be filled with the qualities, these divine qualities that we've been given. And so, yes, I would say when we try with our best intentions to say to a friend, hey, this is the way, you know, what we are saying is, when I asked God, please would you meet me on this way, God said yes. And so what I would tell people is, if you feel a yearning in your own heart, that means spiritually you're not home yet. And that means that's a good thing. God has, you know, given a promise to your own heart that says, and there's more. And your heart says, how do I know this? But I know that there is more. And so you come to God not with, oh, I've got it all, but you come to God with, what are you asking me to do? So, like, there's this new song on this upcoming CD that starts out with the words, Jesus called me a hypocrite when I said that I was saved. And I'm surprised when this song shows up in my heart, and I'm saying, you know, this is a reflection of how God's asking me to walk beyond the sort of passwords and kind of the safe community where I find like-minded people. You know, this is my church, these are my people. And I realize that if we're following this amazing, wild carpenter, and we're in our sort of little theological gated community, we look around and, hey, wait a minute, he's outside the gates. And this is a little unnerving, because we're saying to him, come on, Jesus, you're supposed to be in here with us, remember? It's all about you. And he's saying, well, actually, if you read a little closer, I'm the guy who tends to be out here with the people, asking you to walk with me in this mercy. And so the chorus of the song is to be the mercy. And so my long, convoluted, probably frustrating answer to your simple question is, I am so grateful that in my experience God has met me at the place where my yearning comes up against my own confusion, my own lack of certainty. And when I come to the place where I say, God, I don't know what the next step for me is to walk closer to you, can you find me, can you help me, I have always felt that strange, alive feeling in my heart, that strange opening of my heart, and this feeling that that I am met right where I am for the next step.
All right, let me see if I could put words in your mouth. God is bigger than Christianity?
Well, I think that Christianity is, I mean, there's always like a church within a church. So let me say that the heart of Christianity, Jesus, is enough that if we are following Jesus, we walk that bridge to God. So that I say yes. And if I am following Jesus, I don't have to worry about trying to take extracurricular, you know, courses here and there to try and capture the rest of God. So in a way, I could answer your question with, it is enough. And that's sort of the other end of that question, I realize. I kind of on purpose stayed away from answering the question of, like, is this like the only? Because
right.
That's, I think part of what we're here to do is to be daily, hourly, up against choices where we're caught in this place where the best of what we know is not enough. And we're called to have mercy, and we're called to ask again and again, wait a minute, I'm supposed to love my neighbor. Who is my neighbor? Oh, well, maybe it's this person here that I wouldn't have said is enough like me that I would think, oh, maybe this person's not my neighbor. Maybe this person is my enemy. But this is the person that God has put beside me in this moment. And so can my heart choose love now in the face of this uncomfortable feeling of, you know, gee, I don't know if we're enough alike. I don't know if we're enough the same. And
David, you know, processing the stuff that you are saying is, it's just too hard work. No, and I mean that in a sort of a facetious way, because really we need to process the stuff that you're saying. We need to just process stuff instead of living in a processed faith, like processed cheese. We look for the bumper sticker quick fix answers. We look for, I see you have a focus on the family literature in your house, then I know you're saved kind of thing, right? And so you don't know me from a bar of soap or where I'm at as far as this interview goes, but this is certainly not an ambush by any stretch of the imagination. I really am genuinely interested in how you are perceiving your own spiritual walk. You know, where are you at? Where are you going? When you die, what do you think? What's the crapshoot say at the end of the day? You know, are you, you know, some tree hugging Baha'i sort of, pluralistic kumbaya guy, or are you a follower of Christ? You know, do you love Jesus kind of stuff? And like the Franciscan movement started because a change was needed in the way people saw God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this happened several times through history, the Reformation, Wesley movement, et cetera. And I think maybe we've religionized Christianity to the point where, although it's full of many true and real believers, we've lost the real Jesus and are due for some reformation.
I think that's always the case, and I think that that's not only the case within the life of an institution, but it's always the case within an individual life. I mean, I know my heart goes through the same sort of reformations where I'll sort of feel like, okay, this is great. I've got it wrapped up because I read those scriptures and I know that I'm on the right road and it's all good. And then I will get humbled again where I'm in a situation where I'm not behaving like Jesus. And I think to myself, what's missing here? And usually what's missing is my sense of awe, my sense of wonder. And if I am sort of like, kind of, if I've closed the book, so to speak, on, you know, what I need to know about what God is asking from my own heart, what God is asking from my own life.
So is it better to maybe to get the message of God across through means other than mainstream Christianity these days?
I think, what a question. Let me think. I think that our job is to be the hands and the voice of Jesus in any way that we are directed to do that, in any way that that we are guided in our hearts to do that. And we need to be everywhere that there's people that we can interact with. So obviously there are people who are in that language and in that community that are best served by, stay with what they're ready to hear and start with that. And I know that there are friends of mine who are so grateful for the structure, for the history, for the fact that the church has been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are people whose lives are saved by that rigid structure, and that's great. But in a way, it reminds me of when my son broke his arm years ago, and when it was time to take the cast off, he had a huge wake-up because he first, noticed that he didn't have strength in his hand, and he was, scared, this is the way his arm was going to be for the rest of his life. And we were trying to explain that, no, the cast was necessary because it was holding the weakened place so that it could grow strong. It let the bone set. But the downside of wearing a cast is that, yes, you do atrophy because you don't wind up using the movement, the strength, the aliveness that you have. And so he sort of got this when he looked at the cast that he had been wearing, and it was signed by all his friends, and it had become sort of a part of him, he suddenly saw it as repulsive. He suddenly saw it as, well, this made me weak. And what an interesting kind of analogy to say, there are times when the best thing that you can do is put a cast on an arm. There are lives that are broken that come to the church, and they're in the midst of just real brokenness, the addictions, the sorrow, the all kinds of stuff. And the church can say, do this and don't do that. Keep it simple. You know, here are the things that you must follow. And when you do that, your life starts to mend, and the bone starts to heal. The cast can actually save your life. And yet, if you start wearing it not as a brace when you need it, but if you start wearing it as a fashion statement, then you realize, well, wait a minute. All my friends signed this, and it's sort of a part of me, but is there a part of me that needs to be as strong now as that cast was? And I would say yes. I would say that what we're called to do is not just follow in the confines of what institutions can give us, but to actually be the living church, be the words, be the hand of Jesus in the moment when somebody comes up and they're asking us to be real with them and explain what our faith does, how we can live day to day in this world with this beautiful vision of kindness and compassion. And they're coming to us with real confusion, like saying, you've got something. I can tell. I saw the way you were with your kid. I saw the way you were with your wife. I saw the way you were with your boss. You've got something. What is it? And if we come to them with, well, I go to this church and it meets at 10:30, they're saying, no, I'm not talking about sort of the structure of it. I mean, like, what does it feel like right now when you do that? Where do you get that from? Where does that come from? And so there are times that, for the sake of our own protection, the rigidity of what an institution can give us is life-saving. It's a cast when we need it, when we are broken. And I think as we heal, as we mend, then what we're asked to be is more alive and able to move without just kind of that fear, without that huge protection of the structure, but actually to be seen as, no, this is the way I am walking to God step by step as I feel this beautiful balance of the pull of the, what I would call the promise, which is that hunger, that ache in our heart that promises there is more. And walk that with the daily sort of, and this is who I was yesterday, and this is who I am serving in my life, and I can, you know, kind of. So it's both, and it's a beautiful balance, and I think that the protection and the nurturing, it's sort of like the male and the female. You know, they're not here to fight each other. They're here to marry each other. They're here to nurture each other.
Okay, big conversational lull again. Thank you very much for that.
You have such a great sense of humor about this, and I love that there is a time and a place on the radio for these conversations. And thanks for being brave with all this.
Well, I made the mistake a long time ago of being a little too preoccupied with, oh, are you a Christian? Are they Christian? Is it? I remember my first conversation with Kathy Lee Gifford. I said, I am so sorry for judging you from the other side of the television set just by seeing what I saw, you know, of you and Regis, whatever, whether you were a Christian or weren't a Christian. That was just a bad place I was in. I really am trying to get what you're saying, and I think I get it, but it is hard work to process this stuff because it's so lateral, it's so I mean, I even hesitate to use the phrase outside the box, because if you use the phrase outside the box, you're still in the box. New World, Big Horizon, open your eyes and see it's true. New World, across the frightening waves of blue. There's a quote from Chapter 10, the start of The Shack. Did you know you had a quote in there?
Yeah, I love that. I met that guy at the prayer breakfast. He's wonderful.
Paul loves you.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd say that.
Yeah. It's mutual.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Middle East, Gaza. Let's finish with that. What's going on, man?
Well, what I love is asking that same question, what's going on, as what is God making here? And I love when we realize that we are living in a perfect world for living out our faith. And the reason why it's a perfect world for living out our faith is because we actually have something to do. We actually have decisions that matter. And we are in a position to come to a place where we are personally scared, where we're personally scared, like, God, I feel in my heart that I am being asked to do this. And it feels like it's scary, because I know that you've told me that I am a believer of this and this and this. And yet when I stand here and my own heart is breaking, I have to, you know, do things that take me beyond that. Just like Jesus said, you know, carry the pack an extra mile. Wait a second, whose pack? The occupying army's pack? No, you would never. And yet, that's what he said. And so when we're asked to live in this world amidst all this struggle, and we realize this is the world we are given, this is the world that that we have to live out our faith. And what I have come to little by little is a gratitude for that, because if we look at it sort of like, well, what would it be like if it were the other way? What would it be like if the world were a nice, safe place? It would be a place where there would be nothing required of us. There would be no reason for our faith to grow. The times in my life that I have loved the most are the times when all of me is required, when I don't have my easy answers ready, and when I know that every decision I make matters. And those are the kinds of situations where we really need God. I mean, the next breath, we're like praying with every breath, saying, I want to not react with anger here. I want to react with the most true following that I can, you know, step into. And so this world that we are given is a frightening place. And I think when we look at this as what is God making here, what God is making here is individual life stories that are beautiful, beautiful stories, because they come up against the place where the fear says, no. And the love says, yes, yes, and yes. And those are the times when life really starts feeling like that the promises are all true, that when we say yes to Jesus, then we've got company in our own heart, in our own minds, in our own there is a strength that was not there before, and we are able to do things that our little human personality would not have chosen to do. And so I look at these opportunities, and like when I am asked to go play the song Three Brothers in Jerusalem, I will say with fear and trembling, yes, it'll be great.
Astounding that the world's three, well, maybe not top three, but three of the top of the world's religions happen to be all on the same rock.
Yeah.
I don't think there's got to be purpose to that.
Yeah, I think it is not just, you know, sort of like some accident. I think it is the world we are given, the world we are divinely given.
DavidWilcox.com is the website. You can find his tunage everywhere, and you can certainly pick up last year's release named after that beautiful trailer you were in forever, Airstream. And looking forward to your release this year, and you've got a documentary coming out, I think, as well.
Yeah, that's fun.
A lot of stuff, man.
That's fun. I do love watching how, you know, my prayer is to sort of be available, you know, to just be...
Be like the donkey that was waiting for Jesus, be an ass for Jesus.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice to be available.
I love that.
Thanks for being available for this interview, David. I really thoroughly appreciate it. I've been looking forward to it. I'm sorry it's taken me 6 years of doing the show to get around to you.
I'm so grateful for you being brave and talking about all this stuff. It's great.
Well, it's stuck in my craw.
Yeah.
From those many years ago back in Australia.
Yeah.
So, but I appreciate your heart, man, and what you do.
Thank you.
And maybe we'll talk another time. I hope we do.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks, mate.
See ya.
Bye-bye. David Wilcox on the Drew Marshall Show. We're going to go out with the song he was just talking about there, folks. Listen to the lyrics of this tune as you think and pray about what's going on in Gaza.
All three brothers love their father, and he's brought them here today to see these papers and these lawyers divide the old estate. All three feel that they're the favorite. He loves each of them the best. And these documents he gave them will now put them to the test. So they open all the writings that will prove the rightful heir to this home that they remember and the right to settle there. Their own sister is a prisoner. They don't see her face to face. They've not heard her song of beauty, felt the movement of her grace. She lives behind those bars of steel and waits for her release. Will she die or will we see Jerusalem? One looks at what he's given, and he studies what he's shown. They hold their maps that show possession to this place they've called their home. First they sigh with satisfaction when they see what's on their maps. Each one's given all he wanted, but the boundaries overlap.